Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all.
On today's episode, I sit down with Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen is an American disbarred lawyer who served as the personal attorney to former President Donald Trump for over a decade. In 2018, he was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison. He is currently living out house arrest on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. He is the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Disloyal, the true story of the former personal attorney to President Donald J. Trump. I would like to reiterate that I'm not here to condone any actions as well as discuss political ideologies. That just won't lead to a worthwhile discussion. I believe each person has a story worth sharing.
Okay, so I am Michael Cohen. I am the former personal attorney and known as the former fixer to our former idiot in chief, known as Donald J. Trump. I also have my own podcast, which is called Mea Culpa, as well as I'm an author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Disloyal. I'm a former attorney, disbarred now as a direct result of some hush money payments made to a porn star.
So where did you grow up? And can you tell us a little bit about your upbringing?
Sure. So interestingly enough, I grew up in a place called Lawrence, which is in the five towns of Long Island, New York. I like to work. And even as a young child, you know, we used to, of course, like everybody else, have the lemonade stand. I, of course, had a little bit of a different twist to how to get the cars to stop. We barricaded the street using benches from my parents' backyard furniture, making people stop. And the only way we would let them through is if they bought a lemonade. Now, the first few times people thought it was kind of cute, bunch of little kids, you know, sort of extorting them for 50 cents or a quarter, whatever it was at the time. Don't forget, it was, you know, what was that? It was like 1972, before you were even a thought there, Eileen. And, you know, what ended up happening is after a while, they ended up calling my mother and saying, you know, you really got to stop him. But it was a joke. But interestingly enough, I didn't do it simply to extort everybody. What we did is with all the money that I had made, you know, in selling this lemonade, I bought everybody on the block ice cream from a guy by the name of Tiny, who had the consumer truck. So that's really what it was. It wasn't so much about the money, right? It was more about just being able to, you know, be the big schwitz on the block and just buying everybody whatever they wanted from, you know, Tiny's ice cream truck.
Yeah, being the neighborhood kind of point person.
Yeah, we'll say that.
So, you know, this is a mental health podcast. So when I was thinking of like, okay, what do I want to talk to you about and where should we jump off from? I think a good place to start is really talking about your time away in prison. What was prison like? And since you were such a unique inmate, kind of going in there as, you know, a famous, quote unquote, controversial inmate, do you feel like that had kind of an effect on how you were treated in your time there?
Yeah, so I wasn't the only, we'll call it, famous person. Table mate was Mike the Situation from the Jersey Shore. We also had a very well-known and respected Republican state senator by the name of Senator Skelos from Long Island, who was there. We had others who were also very high profile. But I was a little bit different than everybody else because I was, at the time, I was the highest profiled inmate in the Bureau of Prisons altogether. And many of the so-called correctional officers and administration didn't really know what to do with me. Now, I want people to understand, I self-surrendered, meaning I drove up to the institution. A buddy of mine lent me his car and his driver. And his driver, who was former correctional officer himself over at Rikers Island, took me up there. And as we were traveling, there were a multitude of news reporters that were chasing us in their vehicles. And there were four helicopters overhead waiting to get the picture of me coming out of, you would think that I was Al Capone reincarnated. I'm just a guy who paid a porn star, hush money, because she pulled the president's pecker, right? I mean, so let's be serious. Next thing you have, they literally shut down both institutions. Now, I want people to understand what Otisville is like from a physical perspective. There's two buildings. There's the buildings that I was in, which is known as the satellite camp. There's no gates. There's basically two guards for 120 guys. There's a tennis court, not a good one. It's on concrete, so a lot of people hurt themselves. Basketball, we had a little softball field, a gym with some very old and broken down machinery. There was like a little running track. And, that's where we spent the bulk of our days if we weren't working. I actually worked every single day. But then there's the other side of the street, the FCI Medium Institution. And that place is exactly what you would expect. 20-foot high gates surrounded by two layers of barbed wire. There's guards everywhere. The inmates there are, rather formidable individuals, right, who have committed much more dangerous crimes than the folks that were on my side. Where I was at, like I said, there were about 120 guys. Half of them were 50 and over, probably 30%, 60 and over. They're all white collar guys, except for a couple, who were step downs from the penitentiary. But ours was fully safe. Nevertheless, prison really sucks. I mean, you miss your family terribly. I missed, Laura, and I missed, my children terribly every second, especially in the fact that, the disproportionate sentencing that I received because of the political nature of the, of the charges against me were, always on my mind. Now, since this is a mental sort of health type of a podcast, there's two ways that you can do your time, right? You can do it bitter, or you can try to make the best of the time during the worst of times. And for me, I get a lot of people even to this day on my Twitter account and Instagram who have pretty nasty things, to say. Why are you out of prison? You should be in. I destroyed, America, by bringing us Trump. And others, of course, start to attack them. And it's a back and forth. And that's a whole nother topic. But for me, as I tell people all the time, I try to do my time in the best way I possibly can. I worked every day doing something. If I wasn't working, now I worked at what was called the pipe shop there. So I was rebuilding all the fire hydrants. I've always loved to work with my hands, even as a kid. So I learned how to rebuild fire hydrants. I learned how to weld. I learned how to use pipe ending machines. And all the various different saws. We built a lot of stuff. I built two bathrooms while I was there, including installations of showers. So we did a lot of construction because the place legitimately is a fucking shithole. It's really fucking gross. It's like,
but it's nicer than the one across the street, right?
Well, the one across the street is actually different from a physical structure. The one across the street is in better shape. They didn't want to fight with the inmates over the facility itself. The satellite camp was really dirty and it was disgusting. I literally by myself and then asked two other guys, this guy named John and another guy named Tito, if they would help me. And we repainted the entire place just to make it look fresh. The doors didn't properly fit. So I tried to put spacers underneath because you're 3,000 feet. On the top of a mountain. So it got very cold at night, especially during the winter. One time we took a thermometer, we put it on my bed. It was 38 degrees on my bed, during the nighttime. and they don't give you heavy blankets. So the point I was making is I worked every single day. And if I wasn't working, I spent a lot of time on the tennis court. But we played also a lot of softball. So I want people to understand that the FCI satellite camp, we had tennis rackets, we had baseball bats. So it wasn't like the movies that you see. Now, that's the time that I was at the satellite camp. When COVID broke out, they put us all in solitary confinement on the other side. And that was really horrific. And you asked me a good question, which is, did they treat me differently? They most certainly did. Many, many of the correctional officers were pro-Trump lovers. And so therefore, they really, truly enjoyed abusing me, the way that they could, dumping my locker, pulling everything out for no reason whatsoever. When I was put into a cell and that door is closed and locked and you're in there 24/7, my window was broken, meaning it was missing a whole plate of glass. So at nighttime, the rain used to come in on me. And then when, of course, the heat would come through at about 105 degrees with no ventilation, all the bugs would come in, and I would just, ask them for even a piece of plastic, to cover that broken part of the window, which they wouldn't give to me. So I ended up during laundry change, I snuck out a T-shirt and I used the T-shirt to fill in the hole. And then I was able to get some scotch tape from books that was sent to me from Amazon and secured it. But it didn't matter. It was terrible. The rooms are filthy. They're broken. The bathrooms don't work properly. The place is really a complete dive, to say the least.
How did you keep yourself motivated to keep going?
It's hard. So you really have to become structured. I mean, I read 97 books and I wrote my book Disloyal while I was there. And I spent a lot of time working and I spent a lot of time playing tennis. And that's why I was telling you a little bit about the facility. We played a lot of softball on weekends, a lot of basketball. Sometimes you would just by yourself go outside, grab a basketball and then just shoot simply to pass an hour, or two. And then you would sit sometimes in one of the various rooms and watch television. And television is also another funny thing, because even though this was the satellite camp where there's really no violence at all, people would get violent over the remote control to the television. So depending upon your seniority would depend upon what show was being watched. And there were quite a few times that, things got a little bit, let's just say,
heated,
rowdy. I was known to start that crap too, because there's no reason to have two televisions with the same program on in the same room. It just didn't make any sense. But, it's my time. It's my remote control. I get to choose and I want to watch it. I'm like, well, why don't you turn your head to the left? Because we're not going to watch this also. We're not going to have two. And then generally everybody was pretty, good with one another. When you get there, you have absolutely nothing, not your own clothes. You have one pair of underwear, one T-shirt until commissary when you start buying your own stuff. But as a group, for new people coming in, everybody always stocked up on extra items. So when people would come in, you'd give them shampoo, bar of soap, something to hold the soap, a toothbrush, a comb, deodorant, a pair of underwear, new, a T-shirt, whatever it was, a pair of sneakers. Whatever you can give to somebody else, some food. Food is also a big thing in prison. Some of the Spanish guys really learned how to cook with a microwave. You would think you were at a Jean George restaurant. It's truly amazing. I mean, they would make out of tortilla. They would make pizza that was as good as any pizza I've ever had anywhere. It's really, truly, some of the guys were really just amazing, really talented.
Do you feel like you gained a new appreciation while you were there for like the smaller things in life?
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you start to, realize how much you actually have. I want all of your listeners for a second, to just think about what they have and start just by looking at you know, your fingers. If you're a female, how many rings on your finger? If you're a guy, if you have a ring, you have a watch and so on. There's none of that. You have to buy it. You come in with nothing. Go into your underwear drawer where you have probably 10, 20 pairs of underwear that's sitting there. You have nothing. You have absolutely nothing. And, you know, it's really humbling. But what made it even more difficult for me, again, is a whole series of these correctional officers. They enjoyed sort of being able to go home to their, you know, local watering hole and brag about how, you know, they abused me or they did something that would be just, you wouldn't do to another person, even if you hated them, you know. So, you know, they would take my stuff and throw it out. I would get certain documents that would come in. They would shred them in shredders. I mean, just, you know, petty stuff. So you really have to learn to put aside all of your anger and all of your emotions, because if you don't, you just become a very bitter inmate.
Yeah. How did you do that though? Like, how did you calm your emotions, or in certain situations where it probably would have made your life a lot harder if you acted on them? Like, yeah. How did you do that?
So
you learned to sit on it.
The answer to that, and it's a little upsetting, you know, thinking back, is everything that they do to you as an inmate is meant to denigrate you. And worse than even denigrating you is they're constantly threatening you, especially me. So their response was, you know, if I get out of line or I do anything that they deem to be inappropriate, the Bureau of Prisons, they have the right to what's called remand you to another facility wherever they want to send you. And it's actually in the prison system, it's known as diesel therapy. They put you handcuffed and shackled. It's called the box. So think of a small little black box that your handcuffs go through, and then the chain to your ankles go into that box as well. So you basically can't move. And then they put you onto a bus and you have no idea where you're going. They just send you, and you could end up in Arizona. And, you know, there's no usage of a bathroom or anything. And they could remand you to a maximum security facility. You could legitimately go from, like, what I was at, which is a satellite camp, to a max security. And nobody will even know, because they do it in the middle of the night. So you really do need to curb yourself. And I didn't curb myself because I wanted to. There were many times I wanted to smack the shit out of some of these guards. Because, you know, they walk around all tough and shit. Yeah, of course it's tough when you're sitting there, right? And nobody has firearms and billy club, none of that crap, right? But some of them just, they walked around thinking that, you know, they're, you know, that they're the UFC champion of the world, right? And so on. And they're just abusive guys who enjoyed being able to turn around and to tell people that this is what I did today. Some of them really have some of their own serious mental problems.
Do you feel like this your experience there has changed your views on the criminal justice system?
Oh, yeah. And it's funny, because most people, myself included, would turn around and say, only guilty people go to prison. And you know what? I've never gone to prison. So therefore, you know, I'm not guilty. So therefore, the system must be just. Well, it's not. And it's not only is it not just, the Department of Injustice is set up so that once you become part of that system, you can never get out. It's amazing, because especially with my case, being it was so high profile, first your banks all start dropping you, then your credit cards, then the mortgages that you have on properties. Because I had, you know, a lot of real estate in the city. They don't want to do business with you. Then you have to start selling. Then you have to start transferring assets and so on. And the system doesn't even allow you to come back. It's incredibly, even with somebody like myself, it is so difficult to make it back. But going more deep into your question, the Department of Injustice, if they want you, you know, there's an old adage, which is you can indict a ham sandwich. There's not a person out there that cannot be indicted. Actually, I'll give you two examples. There's a book that I read while I was there. It was by Harvey Westlake, and it's called Five Felonies a Day. Basically identifying that each and every person in life commits about five felonies a day that they could put you away for.
Like what?
Let's say you have a drink and, you know, you're only a couple blocks away from your home. So you get in and you drive. That's a felony, all right, in and of itself. Or, I mean, there's another one, which actually was by Sidney Powell. I think it was called something like The Prosecutor's Lie. And it was all about Enron. And it shows how there was one guy who was involved who had nothing to do with it, but they needed to nail somebody. And so they put it on him. The prosecutors all have judicial immunity. They have prosecutorial immunity. So they do whatever they want. They fail to provide the proper information to the defense counsel. They violated a multitude of laws, but they have immunity. And so this guy ended up going to prison. Again, it's actually somebody who's as crazy as Sidney Powell is. I mean, she's just a wackadoodle. It's a great book. And I can only tell you that my belief is that the entire Justice Department needs an overhaul, and the entire criminal justice reform is something that I push for every single day.
Yeah. Because of COVID, you got released early to house arrest. I want to talk a little bit about and see what that was like and, you know, what house arrest even looks like. You have to wear an ankle monitor, I believe.
No, I don't have an ankle monitor. It's run through my cell phone. It's called a smart link that goes right there so they can just, you know, beep you. They constantly call my house, you know, to make sure that I'm here. But for me, it's not worth it. You know, at first when I got out, they did put an ankle monitor on, but I had it removed. Just not only was it hurting me, but on top of that, it's also unnecessary. And so they agreed and they removed it several months ago. But house arrest is not easy. People think that it is. I'm allowed out 2 hours to just go outside into the park. 1 hour in the gym, which, you know, I try to do daily. And the rest of the time, I am at home. So very much like being in prison, other than the fact that I could control my own Netflix and Hulu, and I can catch up and binge watch on all the shows that I seem to have missed over the 13 months that I was away. But for me, again, I've been working on now a second book. I started my podcast, Mea Culpa, which is number 9 on all podcasts. In a short period of time, I have now about 7.5 million downloads to date and a wide, wide audience of individuals, going back to my very first episode with Rosie O'Donnell, all the way up through Ben Stiller and Joy Behar and Malcolm Nance and General Mark Hertling, you name it. It's the 71 episodes so far.
But you wouldn't be able to do that if you were in prison.
That's also true. Not to mention I'm constantly on television and speaking with reporters. I've also had the good fortune of being asked half a dozen times to meet with the district attorney's office in the upcoming case of the New York district attorney versus Trump. Trump Org and others as a, you know, important witness in that specific case. Working on a television show, which I think is interesting. And my book is being adapted into a full-length feature theatrical film. So I'm trying to keep myself a little busy.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you feel like when you returned home to the house arrest, did you feel like you experienced any kind of like social anxiety or, you know, returning to New York, being in close proximity to friends again?
So it's a great, great question. If I can sort of phrase it a little bit different, you know, how was I received on the way back is more like it. You know, some of our very close friends, took such good care of my wife and my kids while I was away that I'll never forget them or their kindness during the worst time you could imagine in anybody's life. I mean, we don't go anywhere without one another. I've never left my wife, mm-hmm. you know, for a guy's weekend or anything like that. So it was very difficult. But many of our friends have been incredibly, incredibly supportive. Then, of course, there are others that have just abandoned ship as if I was, you know, Jack the Ripper. It's truly amazing to me. And the ones that actually abandoned ship are probably the ones that are most guilty of, like in the book, Five Felonies a Day, of committing these felonies, and they don't want to be anywhere near it, not sure whether or not my phones are tapped or, you know, somebody's still reading my emails. And I try to explain to them every now and then. I'll bump into them on my walk. First of all, they never were eavesdropping on my phone calls. They were just checking to see who I was calling and who I wasn't. But yes, they did take control over my Gmail and our cloud, here in the apartment. But, you know, so what? I mean, what did they get me on? Campaign finance violation? I mean, let's be serious. And the other violations that I was, you know, I had to plead guilty to, you know, I pled guilty because I needed this to stop for my family. I didn't plead guilty because there's guilt, right?
What was it like, you know, seeing Samantha, seeing your kids again when you came home, seeing your wife, just the whole family?
There's nothing more important to me. You know, as I said, even to George Stephanopoulos on that interview, when everything sort of changed for me, my loyalty in life has always been to Laura, Samantha, Jake, and of course, you know, my country. And that's when I decided that it was time to stop this bullshit of protecting Trump and family to my own detriment, because these individuals are, you know, soulless. They lack any empathy for anyone. And all they wanted was, you know, to throw me under the bus, hoping that it was going to stop the discussions about the Russian collusion and all of the other various things. And he was stupid. Instead of abandoning me the way that he did, you would think that under the circumstances, they tried to pull me in closer to prevent me from doing what I did. And that's to testify before 9 different law enforcement agencies for over 300 hours of testimony, including one that you may have seen on television before, rest in peace, the Honorable Elijah Cummings, the House Oversight Committee, where, you know, it was viewed by close to 100 million people, which was more than the Super Bowl itself.
I know. I remember that. What was that like? Just even the paparazzi going on TV, what do you feel like you've had lasting, just like psychological effects or anxiety, or what your family had to go through with the whole situation?
So, you know, it's hard to talk about the family other than to say that we all are suffering from PTSD in some sort of different capacity. You know, people think that, you know, it's easy on, you know, Samantha, Jake. It's not. And you can see there are some people that, you know, embrace you when, you know, things are going badly. And then there are others that just have nothing but, you know, have blackness in their heart, where they enjoy somebody else's misery, most probably because they're miserable in their own lives. But it is what it is. And, you know, sometimes life deals you a kick in the right, you know, a kick in the ass with steel tip boots. We got it a couple of kicks. For me, yeah. Sleeping is very difficult. You know, something that they do to you in prison is when you're asleep, every like 15, 30 minutes there, they walk around and they have this million watt flashlight, and they flash it into your eyes. And they do that just to see you jump so that they can make sure that you're still alive. Well, the problem is I'm a terrible sleeper in the first place. So then it would mess up my sleep pattern continuously, which is why I got up every day at 4:30 in the morning. And that's when I would have my breakfast.
But I feel like that can actually make someone go crazy.
Well,
like not having enough sleep.
Well, I've never really been much of a sleeper, but, you know, it is enough to make you loopy and tired. And it really does test your sense and sensibilities, to say the least. You know, and then you take Jake, who's off in college, and then, you know, fraternities didn't want him to pledge. And this is going back now 3 years. They didn't want him to pledge because of the name recognition. And, you know, if they're underage and then there's drinking, then they come in, it's going to become a bigger issue because of who he is. That way the press can tie it to me, you know, and so on. So they didn't give him bids, you know, for that. So, you know, that was wrong. And, you know, it was, I feel terrible for him, you know, about that. But like I said, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, you know, or as the adage goes.
Yeah. How did you even meet Trump?
Well, stupidly me, I decided to move. We were living on 87th Street and we needed a bigger apartment. Sammy required more closet space. Jake required more space to drive his electric car inside. So, you know, I found an apartment that we were interested in buying, which happens to be in a Trump building. And I had already been an investor in Trump, various different Trump buildings, just by coincidence. And in one of the buildings, I talked about this in the book, again, Disloyal, you know, which was Trump World Tower. There was a very significant issue that he was confronting where they wanted to pull his name off of the building. And I was asked to come in because I had an apartment there. My parents, my in-laws, friends of mine, we all bought as a big block. And Don Jr., who was building my apartment where we're at now, you know, he's the one that made the introduction. And after successfully overturning the board there, you know, it got me onto Trump's radar in order to handle various different matters for him until he ultimately just asked me to quit my job, which was at a white glove law firm here in the city, and to join the Trump Organization as the executive vice president of the company and his special counsel. And that was the beginning of my doom. And interestingly enough, Laura, Sammy, Jake, none of them wanted me to take the job. They really didn't want me to take this job at all. And over the course of the years, the more than a decade of time, you know, they had constantly tried to push me to leave. I mean, there was one opportunity I had to join a company with Mark Cuban that he owned. And, you know, I remember Sammy just saying to me, how could you not join Mark Cuban? You know, I mean, the guy's just brilliant. And, you know, this is a guy who you'd want to work for, not, you know, not somebody like Trump. And Jake, of course, just wanted so that way we can go front row to the Dallas Mavericks. Right. But, you know, none of them wanted me to, you know, to stick around, especially so many times over the years. Trump had done things which were so disrespectful that if it was anybody other than Trump, I would have put him right on their ass, you know, because it just, it borderlined, you know, not even stupid. It was obnoxious. And, you know, I held myself back, I'm still to this day not sure, including, you know, when he started making very inappropriate comments about Samantha when she was coming off of the tennis court. When she was about 16.
Yeah, I remember that. I think to kind of broaden that out, it speaks to just Trump's general misogyny and just view of women in general. And do you feel like being around that for so long impacted your own view of women? You know, you're a father, you're a loyal husband.
The answer to that is emphatically no. You know, his view of women is his. I never treated my daughter, you know, the way that, you know, Donald would treat, you know, his daughter, Ivanka. We all know of the famous line when he said, if she wasn't my daughter, I'd be dating her. I've never, you know, even thought of, you know, my daughter as anything other than the love of my life, you know, my child, right? The same way I think of my son, right? You know, I'm also married to the same woman for 26 years, you know, he was very quick to get rid of one, then the second, then the third, and guaranteed Melania will be gone too, right? Which is a comment that he would make all the time if she gets out of line. But listen, she's replaceable. Even that time that Trump made these inappropriate comments about Samantha, and we were talking, he turned around, he said to Samantha, if you ever see my number show up on your cell phone, don't answer it. And then he finished the comment by saying, and this is really gross, you know, chances are down the road, I'll be dating one of your friends. Now, you know, it's just an inappropriate thing. I remember Samantha was going to throw up on his, you know, on his golf shoes. But it's just an inappropriate thing for, you know, a fat old man to say to a 16-year-old, you know, especially a 16-year-old who's the daughter of, you know, your executive vice president of your company and a guy that's been watching out for your ass, you know, for the last, say, at that time, 6 years, five, 6 years. So,
well, does no one speak up in those moments? Like, no one says anything when he says stuff.
You know,
like that?
you take Donald Trump sort of for who he is. You know, so many times, you know, he would say something, and one of the other guys that I was very close to at the time in the organization would come to my office, and they'd be like, "Oh man, you know what this fucking asshole just said, right?" And then we would go on, and we'd talk about how actually stupid he is, almost to the point, you know, his spelling is atrocious, his use of the English vocabulary is atrocious. You know, everything is, you know, brilliant. It's wonderful. It's sunny. It's sweet. It's great. You know, he uses like third grade language, but he also behaves like a third grader. I mean, these comments are something that, you know, like an elementary school kid would say, not a grown man with, you know, five children, you know, on his third wife would say. It's just absolutely inappropriate all the time, from the Miss USA pageants to the Miss Universe to the, you know, Miss Teen USA pageants, you know, all the comments were just inappropriate. But it's a good, there's no point in fighting with Trump over his comments because you just can't win. And he becomes very abusive because he had all the power. And so you ask people, even those that were working in the White House, John Bolton wrote a whole book about it. He just didn't want to fight with Trump. And that's John Bolton, for God's sakes, right? So you just, you listen, you let it go through one ear, right out the other, and you basically just shake your head and you say, you know, listen, he's just an idiot, you know, but, you know, we're working on some really cool projects, so you put it off to the side. You know, many people work for stupid people. You know, many people work for people who are abusive. And, you know, to your listeners, here's my advice as we close up, you know, on this. Don't stand your ground. Do not allow anybody to sort of guide your path of right and wrong. We all know what's right. We all know what's wrong. And if it's on that borderline, you make the decision. But when you know something is wrong, regardless of, you know, your job, regardless of your boss or what the outcome will be, under no circumstances should you allow them to manipulate you and basically throw your life into a dumpster, because that's what they're willing to do. A narcissistic sociopath, there are many of them. I work for one. Many people work for individuals just like that. And sometimes you just have to say no.
So your book is called Disloyal. Obviously, you were loyal to Trump for so many years. Did you feel like it was really difficult for you to break that allegiance?
Really difficult. And people have to understand that it's no different than getting out of a cult. It is really, really difficult. And, you know, I say this, and I've said this on television and also, you know, to various different press outlets. I didn't leave on my own volition. I left because I was, in essence, excommunicated from the Church of Trump. Or the cult of Trump, whereby, you know, they needed a scapegoat. They made me into that scapegoat, and I refused to allow history to remember me as the villain of his story. Remember that the affair with both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal occurred about 6 years before I started even working for the guy. And, you know, even as an example, there were allegations made that I had sent somebody, or I went to Nevada or wherever the hell Stormy was, that she was with her child, to threaten her. That was a year before I was even working for Trump. I didn't even know who Stormy Daniels was until, you know, until many years later. You know, but it was so easy for people to just pile on, like Michael Avenatti. He just piled on to anything and everything because it was easy, and he made himself into this, you know, this martyr for an anti-Trumpian cause, ultimately to bite him in the ass. He's going for sentences. But this is a guy who stole money from everyone, including Stormy Daniels. He took her book money. He took money from a federal inmate who, you know, had a $5 million settlement against, you know, against the government. He took money from even, what's his name, McDreamy, you know, in a coffee company. It's, It's amazing how people project their own negative attributes onto somebody else, maybe to make themselves feel better. I don't know. But Stormy on my podcast, she was a guest, asked me if the two of us can go to his sentencing together. And I asked her if I'll try to get permission from the Bureau of Prisons to be permitted to go.
How do you feel like you were seduced by Trump? Like, was it his charisma, or what was so enticing about his personality to you?
Yeah, so it's more than just charisma. You know, there was so much going on. And I guess I was lacking something in my own personal life that needed this sort of energy or excitement as I saw it. We'll call it like celebrity excitement. I don't know if you've ever been around somebody who is sort of in the celebrity world larger than life. When I first joined him, don't forget, the Celebrity Apprentice, or The Apprentice, was the number one show on television. On top of that, there were buildings all over the place. There were dozens and dozens of licensing deals going on. You never knew who was going to stop into the office. You know, it could be anywhere from Shaq, who came, you know, to see me, to Miss Universe, to, you know, the dog that won the Westminster. You had no idea who was popping in on any given day. You know, I had the opportunity to sit, for example, with Trump and this guy named Ike, who owns Marvel, along with Henry Kissinger, just the four of us in a room. I mean, you know, some people would say, so what? No, it's a really big thing. And especially if that's your thing. And, you know, the celebrity power, the stardom, the action, you know, it, for me, it was incredibly enticing, and it sucked me in. And I was, unfortunately, better than just about anybody in the company in terms of fixing his multitude of issues, because I always thought out of the box. And, you know, I had a very successful career in a life prior to Trump. You know, people don't understand this, but when I went to work for Trump, the only reason I ended up taking the job is because I could afford to take the job. Trump doesn't pay well. And I was semi-retired at the age of 39. I got very lucky early on. But all of that was taken away from me. So as I tried to explain to people, even in the book Disloyal, my story with Trump, despite what the haters want to say, oh, you used him to make money, he paid your life. My story is not a rags to riches story. To the contrary, it was a riches to rags story, and which is what makes my story so different than anybody else's, because they all used Trump to make money. I did not.
Yeah, the media called you Trump's fixer, and I feel like you just mentioned that. But like, what does a fixer even do?
Well, just whatever the problem may be, from his simple as, you know, Barron needing to go to school, all the way to fixing a CNBC poll. You know, you name it. Anything that was bothering him, he would then give to me to handle. And a lot of it had to do, you know, as well with, legality. So where somebody would defame him, and he would then have me, go after them legally. I mean, I want people to understand that, you know, while the media enjoyed making it seem that I was Donald Trump's Ray Donovan, I never hit anybody in the head with a baseball bat. I never hit anybody in the knees with a baseball bat, right? There are no dead bodies in Central Park that I was involved with. I have no idea what he did prior to. But it's just not accurate. They tried to make it seem like I was Trump's Ray Donovan. Yes, with a lawsuit. Yes, with, you know, being able to purchase enough IP addresses in order to change the outcome of a poll, or other things. It entice vendors that they're not going to get paid what they thought they were going to get paid. And a multitude of other things, whatever was on his mind that needed to be resolved or fixed, that was my job. And, you know, like I said, I wish I had a time machine, could go back in time, thank him for his very generous offer, and walked away from it, because this has been an incredibly ugly experience, not just for me, but worse for my family, because, you know, it's destroyed their happiness, It's destroyed their peace of mind. And, you know, each and every day we try to take these baby steps, because that's all you can do, is try to take baby steps to bringing us back to, you know, some sense of normalcy, you know, where our life used to be as opposed to where it exists today.
Yeah. Okay, so you talked about how the family felt about Trump, that they never really liked him. I'm guessing that they definitely don't like him right now. Could you kind of walk us through the fallout and how that occurred and kind of where you guys stand now? I'm guessing you don't talk at all and haven't for a long time.
Nah, the last time I spoke to Trump was the day of the raid on our hotel that we were living in. And again, unlike what the media said, I wasn't on the lam with my family two blocks away from our primary residence. We had a flood in the apartment. We were on vacation. We had just come back, opened the door, and you know, the ceiling and the floor connect because the guy from above, his pipe broke. And you know, it was during the dead of winter, whatever, whatever. So we were there in the hotel. And that was that was the last time I ever spoke to him. And as far as, you know, the fallout came after, you know, even the plea, you know, when I started to realize that they're throwing me under the bus. All of a sudden, Trump forgets my name when he's talking about me on television. I mean, you know, it's almost as stupid as you may have seen on Twitter. Stephanie Winston Wolkoff put out a piece from Ivanka Trump in the deposition where they asked her about Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer for Trump Org and for Donald for the last 40 years. She didn't know what his title was. I mean, it becomes comical, and this was under deposition. So, you know, I realized what was happening. And then, of course, Trump decided that he was going to make things even harder and stopped paying on the joint defense agreement with all of the attorneys that were involved. And so it just became, you know, every man for himself. You know, my damage was already done. And now it was time to set the record straight again. You know, when I had said to you before that I was not going to allow history to remember me as the villain of his story. He's the villain of his own story, and he has to stand responsible for his own dirty deeds.
Did it hurt your feelings? I mean, like emotionally, were you like, you're stabbing me in the back? I have been so loyal to you for so many years and put you on a pedestal.
You can only imagine. It shattered my perception of our relationship, you know, where I never thought in my wildest imagination that he would ever do something like that to me. To others, yeah. But to me, why would you do it to somebody who has, you know, been so loyal and has protected you and your family for so long? Why would you do it to me? Especially knowing that information will ultimately come out that will be negative to you. So just from the sense of being intelligent, right? You protect those that protect you because the alternative is really bad. But Trump is too narcissistic. You know, as I write in the book, Disloyal, he's a narcissistic sociopath. So he doesn't think that anybody will protect themselves because he's omnipotent and he's, right? He's all powerful, like the wizard, you know, behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz, you know, pulling all the levers and strings and trying to scare people. But once you know who the wizard is behind, he's really nothing but a pathetic, orange-crusted, bloviated asshole, right? And nothing more, nothing less than that. Who's going to really cry his fucking eyes out when the judge hits that gavel and turns around and gives him a sentence, you know, and then they end up doing to him what they did to me the second you get there. They strip you out. You know, they fingerprint you, they're picturing you, the whole nine yards. And, you know, rest assured, he's uncomfortable in his own skin. So he's going to be one very unhappy camper. And as will Don Jr. and Ivanka and Jared and Eric Trump and Josh Hawley and, you know, Rudy Giuliani, Ted Cruz, all of them. They all really need to be held responsible for their own actions, you know, starting from, you know, the Charlottesville riot all the way to the insurrection on January 6th.
So what do you say to people who, you know, maybe think that if you hadn't been thrown to the wolves by Trump, that you would still be working for him today, that you would still be loyal and a supporter?
Yeah, they're probably right. I don't, like I said, I didn't break out of this cult on my own. You know, I was moving away. You know, a lot of the media, again, they like to say that a lot of this that I'm doing against Trump is because he didn't take me to Washington. Mm-hmm. Now, anybody that's been around our house more than once knows that Trump wanted me to come to Washington. I had the pick of any job that I wanted. I'll never forget, he sat there and he berated Reince Priebus, who was his chief of staff at the time. What position is Michael taking? I didn't want it. I wanted the position that I got, which was personal attorney to the president of the United States of America. I wasn't embarrassed with that title. So, you know, that just, again, it just continues to promote the lies that were told about me. But to be honest, I didn't leave the cult of Trump all on my own, right? I was, as I had stated earlier, I was excommunicated, and I'm so thankful. It's the one decent thing that he did for me in the last 15 years.
Yeah. I wonder though, like when you're with him and now that you've been disillusioned, like how you kind of rationalize the stuff that was going on while you were his right-hand man.
It was part of my job, and yeah. I was expected to do it. And I was anxious for the pat on the back. You know, when you're around Trump and you're in that inner circle, remember, there's only about 20 people in that entire inner circle, maybe 18 people in that entire inner circle. And I mean, the real inner circle. And when he throws his arm around you or he gives you a backhanded praise and so on, it's like a warm light is shining on you. Why? I don't know. I can't explain exactly what it is, but everybody fought for that attention. They fought for the accolade. And not only the employees, but the children as well, because they too wanted the praise from Donald. And it was very rare, but when you got it, it was like, you know, you hit the lotto.
Well, it seems like he sets up his whole life and inner circle family to be very competitive in that way. Like who can get the gold star today?
Yeah, but he makes everybody competitive. So if, you know, one of the other lawyers, one of the other people at the Trump organization were working on something, he would call me in and he would say, go over to so-and-so and tell him that I want you looking over everything. And then he would do the same to me. If I had something that I was working on, he would be like, oh, well, show that to Ivanka. You know, let her get involved in this as well. And then, you know, it just became a competition. And then everybody sort of, it's almost gladiatorial, you know, where, you know, it's broken stick, right? And it's really sharp. And there's only one and there's two people fighting to the death. That's what Trump really liked. He liked to pit people against one another, which is why so many people actually left his administration as well.
Yeah, no job is worth that. You have to prioritize yourself.
Yeah.
And your happiness, your well-being, mental health.
Yep.